Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Tim Lambert, in for Scott Lamar. The issue of memorialization has been front and center across the country over the last few years. One of the biggest topics has been on how the Confederate States of America is publicly remembered through things like statues and buildings named after men who fought and died for the Confederacy. At a place like Gettysburg, the largest battle of the Civil War and the largest ever fought in North America, it's considered appropriate to feature monuments and statues to those who fought for the South. But what about at U.S. military bases? Did you know that there are 10 Army installations, including Fort Bragg and Fort Hood, that are named after Confederate generals? It's a provocative topic, and it's the first issue to be addressed as part of a new discussion series at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle on provocative topics. Named for the enemy. The U.S. Army's Confederate memorialization problem is scheduled to be held tomorrow at 6:30. Retired Brigadier General Ty Sejuli is Professor Emeritus of History at the United States Military Academy at West Point, and he'll lead the discussion. He joins us on the phone. Welcome to the program, General. Also taking part on the show today is Jeff Mengelsdorf, the host of the discussion series and director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. Welcome, Jeff.
Well, Tim, thanks for having us. It's great to be here today.
Okay. And since you're hosting the chat, let's start with you. What are you hoping to accomplish with the series?
So this is really an opportunity where to experience some of the innovation that we're going through at the Army War College. We've always had a series of bringing in speakers and authors on topics. And what we're doing this year is we're really reimagining that program to better align with some of our institutional learning outcomes. And in doing so, we've got a series of four topics. Each of those topics that we've picked is somewhat provocative or controversial in some way. And we've aligned two different authors to come in and speak against it, not in a debate forum, but in two separate sessions, so that then we can, it really becomes a vehicle for our audience to listen to and then have a moderated discussion with, and then try and figure out, okay, what are the relevant points, the areas where there is potential agreement, areas where there's clear disagreement, and how do you assess multiple expert-level perspectives on a topic?
And you certainly picked a doozy to start things off with. Why focus on this topic first?
Well, this is, one of the great things about using, as you would appreciate, having studied history, one of the great things about using historical case studies or historical vignettes is that you've had time to actually study an issue, look at the actual facts surrounding it. By doing things that have happened in the past, you remove a little bit of the present-day tensions in, as well as the personalities of existing leaders today. And that we found that they provide an excellent vehicle for these kinds of discussions.
General Sejuli, welcome to the program. We understand we lost you for a second, but you're back now.
I am back. Great to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. Great to have you. So what's the historical context of how these installations, all located in the South, I should add, came to be named?
Well, they were named in 1917, beginning of World War I, the beginning of World War II. And prior to that, the names were done locally. And they were never a big deal. But in 1917, we went from an army of about 100,000 to one closer to 4 million. And then in World War II, we went from an army of about 150,000 to total number in uniform, nearly 15 million. So we created an enormous number of camps that weren't permanent at the time. And in 1917, they did a centralized selection process of the names by the Army War College. And in 1941, it was more, they didn't do it as centrally. In World War I, they did it to where the national divisions were going. So, in fact, there is Fort McClellan named after General George McClellan from New Jersey because the New Jersey division was training in Alabama. In World War II, it was more after the local sensibilities. But we should understand that in 1917 and in 1940, the South was not a democracy. Only white people could vote. And so when they looked to see what are local sensibilities, it was only white sensibilities, even though the South in some states was nearly 50% African American. So it was done in a deeply racist and Jim Crow era that we named those.
And was this a case of convincing leaders in these communities to surrender land that made it easier for them to swallow that by naming after these Confederate generals who folks making the decisions at that time may have thought of as heroes of the South?
Well, I think that's partially true. There were posts all over the country, but the South had more for two reasons. One, land was cheap, but the other is because the South was a one-party state, in a way. It was all the Democratic Party that controlled all of it. They had much more seniority in the House and in the Senate, and that was a way of for FDR or Wilson, for that matter, of bringing Southerners, white Southerners on board, was to put these large bases in the South. So it was, again, it's all part of the same thing. The power in the South was white Americans preventing African Americans from having a voice. So they went into those areas. And unfortunately for us, those are the ones that remain. So we have 10 Army posts now named after Confederates. Now, some of them went away. So, for instance, Fort Nathan Bedford Forrest, named after the famous Confederate cavalry commander, later started the Ku Klux Klan, was in Tennessee. It was one of our largest bases during World War II, but that closed down. But we still have 10 named after Confederates today.
And I want to get into those 10 in just a moment, but I want to let folks know that we do welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. General, so about these 10 posts, who are they named after, and where are they located?
Well, there are 10 of them. I'll do just a couple of, for instance. So Fort Benning, which is the home of infantry and armor in outside Columbus, Georgia, was named for Henry Benning. He never served in the U.S. Army and was the leading secessionist from the state of Georgia. And he was one of the first people in the country to, in 1849, to argue that the country should be broken up to protect slavery. And he gave an apocalyptic statement on what would happen if African Americans would have the freedom and ended slavery. So he was someone who was never served in the U.S. Army and was a really rabid white supremacist who fought for slavery. He never went above the brigade command for the Confederate Army, but he was someone local to Columbus, and the War Department did this as a favor to the local chapter of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, a neo-Confederate group that fought to change the narrative from the one that where the Confederacy fought for slavery to one that was a more palatable concern. Fort Gordon is named for John Brown Gordon. It's in Augusta, Georgia. Brown never served in the U.S. Army and helped founded the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia after the Civil War. He was a brave fighter for the Confederacy, wounded 5 times at Antietam. But he fought for white supremacy, and in fact, as late as 1890, argued that Georgia should vote for him to continue white rule in the South, and saying that I am for the supreme rule of whites and whites only in the South. And we have others: Fort Hood, named after John Bell Hood, someone who was a general in the Confederate Army. Fort Polk is in Louisiana. Camp Beauregard, named for PGT Beauregard, was superintendent at West Point for 5 days until he was fired for sedition for helping cadets commit treason and leave the academy. And he was one of the ones that fired the first shot at Fort Sumter, starting the Civil War. So we've named these after a mishmash of ones who were. Many of whom weren't even very good fighters for the Confederate cause. But my problem with them is they fought to destroy the United States for the worst possible reason, and that is to perpetuate the enslavement of African Americans in perpetuity.
General Sejuli, are any of these bases named after men who were at West Point, attended West Point?
Yes, most of them were. So Fort A.P. Hill in Virginia, Fort Lee in Virginia, Fort Pickett in Virginia. Hood is also a West Pointer. So most of them are West Pointers. But I think it's interesting to say that for instance, Fort Lee is named after Robert E. Lee, who fought so well, so long, so hard for the Confederacy. But most of the senior officers that were in the Army in 1861 stayed with the United States. So there were 8 U.S. Army colonels from Virginia in 1861. 7 of them stay with the United States, and only one, Robert E. Lee, chooses to fight for the Confederacy. So there were many Southerners, particularly long-serving Army officers like me, who chose to stay with the United States.
So several of those names familiar to folks who know about the Gettysburg Battlefield. Of course, John Bell Hood was part of General Longstreet's attack on Little Round Top on the second day of the battle. General Lee, of course, was here, and A.P. Hill. The question I asked about West Point was, when you attend West Point, you take an oath to the United States. And it would seem to me that these men broke that oath. So why would the Army honor their names this way?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. They did violate. In fact, Lee took the oath to Colonel less than 3 weeks before he resigned his commission to accept a commission with the Virginia. And in fact, he did that before his resignation had been accepted by the U.S. Army. And I think we have to understand the incredibly racist time of 1917 and 1940-41 when they did that. So one way to think about this is what the Army was doing. And remember that there were, and the nation, during this period, there were lynchings of nearly 5,000 African-Americans. African-Americans did not have the vote. And the idea that white America would come back together, reconcile at the expense of African-Americans, was just part of what happened. And in the interwar period from 1925 to 1938, the Army wrote something called the Negro Manpower Policy that discussed how we were going to use African-American manpower, and it's incredibly racist. In fact, they say in those documents that the Negro, and I'm quoting here, the Negro is not of the same race as whites. And so the idea that America, and including the Army, did not see African-Americans as fully human during this period accounts for why they did that. And again, we were a democracy. So the fact that we would take people who violated their oath, fought to destroy the United States of America is a little outrageous. In fact, Article 3, Section 3 of the Constitution says that there's only one crime in the Constitution, and that is waging war against the United States, seen by two different people, is treason. And so that's why I think that we want our bases in the U.S. Army to talk about the best of America, not the worst.
And I should note, when the armed services integrated, it was by executive order in July of 1948. The Army was the last of the armed services to have its plan for compliance approved. So what is your approach?
Against it.
What was that again?
It fought hard against the integration, and much of the memorialization of Lee at West Point is a reaction to the integration forced on it by our politicians.
So what do you see your role as on Thursday during this discussion? Obviously, this is a topic that generates a lot of heated discussion. Maybe it's a little different since we're talking about military bases and a federal piece of property instead of a monument along Richmond's main road, perhaps. But what's your role going to be in facilitating this discussion?
Well, at first is to let people know I grew up with these myths. I grew up with the myth that Robert E. Lee was the greatest human ever. I went to school in segregated schools, and I was bused across town when we started integrating in Alexandria, Virginia, from the all-white school to the segregated black school. And what was the name of the segregated African-American school? Robert E. Lee Elementary. So I grew up with these. I went to Washington and Lee University. I understand why people have these myths and these legends, but they were there to exploit and to ensure white political power. And we just have to be honest about that. And I'm just the first one to say that I grew up with these myths, but I'm really kind of teed off now that I did grow up that way. So my role is to just show the facts of why we have these names and where they came from. And I'm not there to tell anybody how to think, but history is dangerous because it goes after our myth and identity. And when you do that, people will react unkindly. And I've received death threats in my email account here at West Point. Because when you do that, when you go after people's myths and legends, they react, and sometimes violently.
And that's a good point. I want to bring Jeff Mangelsdorf from the Army Heritage Center back into the conversation here. raising that point, this is really about thinking critically and putting things in the context, isn't it, Jeff?
It really is, Tim, and that's why this particular topic is such a good one to lead off with, you know, because fundamentally we're not engaging in the controversy itself. We're not here to take sides. Rather, what we're doing is putting a spotlight on a controversial topic, a provocative topic. Because then that is a vehicle then to discuss really differing perspectives. We want to help our students and our audience figure out what it is that help them come to understand the nature of social controversy and how do perceptions and what's acceptable change and morph over time. All right, so those public perceptions shift over time, and just as he said a moment ago, you know, with academic freedom, we bring in different presenters that we hope will challenge some of our beliefs, challenge some of those myths and legends that are out there. Not because we're trying to resolve a specific issue, but because that provides an excellent vehicle, you know, from an academic methodologies kind of perspective, an excellent vehicle to then start to pull it apart and look at, okay, what are some of the underlying biases, beliefs, things that may have caused this to come about?
And this also seems to fall in where we are as a society right now, where people are in their bubbles. They believe one thing. That belief is reinforced through social media or the media they consume. And they very rarely want to stray outside that to have a discussion. It suddenly becomes an argument.
It's really challenging to get people together and let them have a professional discussion, have academic discourse without with recognizing that many have become grossly polarized by the environment, especially with social media that we're in today.
Once again, we welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Tim Lambert. Welcome back to Smart Talk on WITF 89.5 and 93.3, where we are talking about military bases and how they have been memorialized by being named after Confederate generals, Confederate leaders. It's part of a discussion series being held, kicking off Thursday at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle on provocative topics. Our guest today, Jeff Mangelsdorf, who's hosting the discussion series and director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center, and retired Brigadier General Tyce Julie, is Professor Emeritus of History at the United States Military Academy at West Point. We do have an email question in. I'm going to direct this one to you, General. The U.S. Military Academy teaches critical thinking now, but has that always been the case? And what was the academic methodology during the mid-1850s and 60s? I'm going to test your knowledge on that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, it has not always. It's often been memorization. So I'll tell you one story. I love telling stories about Eisenhower. He hated military history. And I was in charge of the history department here for a number of years. So it hurt me when I read this in his memoirs. And the reason he hated it is because he had to memorize the location of every officer, general officer, at the Battle of Gettysburg. And so in 1915, he and Bradley and all the other cadets went down to Gettysburg and their test was to say where was every single general officer. Now, that is not critical thinking. And I know that the Army War College doesn't do that. West Point doesn't do that. So it was a much more of a memorization than it was anything else. And it was also very, in the 1850s and 60s, it was much more math-based than it is now. So math was the underlying foundation. Now, that's different than Yale and Harvard was at that time, because they were mainly about the classics, learning Greek or Latin. West Point was a math base, but it was still much more based on memorization. In fact, a famous painter once said that he failed the chemistry because he said silicon was the gas, and if silicon hadn't been a gas, he would have been a major general. So, you know, it was about memorization more than critical thinking.
Well, that's really true. During that time period, the West Point was very much a math and engineering kind of school. So it was prepared, and in those days, the level of undergraduate education was very much more focused on hands-on, task-oriented things. So this prepared military officers then to go out and do great things like explore the uncharted territories, explore the frontier in the West. Think, you know, Lewis and Sullivan and some of their explorations and mapping missions.
And General, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask a question, but if you want to follow up, you can.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Teaching future leaders at West Point, why is it important for them to understand this issue as they head into the U.S. military, which is a much more diverse military than it had been, you know, from, you can go by conflicts, I guess, from Vietnam to Korea to World War II.
Yeah, it was one of the things I'm so proud about the U.S. Army. We are one of the most diverse organizations in the world. And so, for instance, Fort Lee is home to Army logisticians, and our sustainers are the best in the history of the world, whether you go back to World War II or today. I mean, think about where we are sustaining combat and soldiers all over the globe. And yet our sustainers are 50% African-American. It's the most diverse part of any part of the Army, and yet it's named for someone, Robert E. Lee, who fought so long, so hard, so well to sustain slavery. And it's just, I just don't think it represents the values that the U.S. Army and the nation has. But we want them to think about this critically because, you know, here at West Point, people live in Lee barracks, and some people don't like that. And you can understand why, but we have to understand the facts behind it, not just the passion. Why did we name these? Why were they named what they were? What was America like during that period? What were we trying to do? Because often our memorialization doesn't tell us about the person; it tells it about who named it. So whether it's a statue or a post, we should know that it's about people in 1917 and 1941 more than it is about somebody in 1860 or 65.
And I guess for more context to that, in 1917, some of those people who made the decision, they weren't that far removed from the Civil War. I mean, maybe their grandparent had fought in that. I remember my grandfather attended the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg in 1913. So it wasn't that far removed at that time period. So was it still sort of fresh even for people making that decision?
Well, it was fresh, but it was a different conception of what the war meant. So the idea that the war was about, as our battle monument says here at West Point, about freeing a race and welding a nation, it was that the two sides became much more equal, that it was Union and Confederate. To me, I never say the word Union. It's like it's some lost to history army. It's, in fact, the U.S. Army. The blue jacket that they wore is the same blue jacket I wore for all those decades. And so they changed the conception, the idea of what the war meant had been changing over time. And you see that with Woodrow Wilson, the first Southern president, who resegregates the federal workforce, the Confederate monument that goes up in Arlington. And in 1913, when he speaks at Gettysburg for that 50th reunion, there are no African-American soldiers there. It's forgotten that nearly 200,000 member African-American soldiers fought for their own freedom and so well for that war. And yet, you know, they go into the war in 1917 where no African-American is allowed to be an officer or very few to be officers in that war. So context is everything. And understanding the history surrounding each one of these incidents helps us understand. I think it's great preparation for Army officers or for anyone to understand war. We are not a militaristic nation. We don't parade down Pennsylvania Avenue like the Russians or the Chinese, but boy, do we go to war. We are a warlike nation who goes to war all the time. And we have to understand our history, our military history, to be good citizens.
Yeah, and at some point there was sort of a parallel history. I mean, in the South, it's the war between the states. It's not the Civil War. The Battle of Antietam has a different name in the South and Bull Run as well. So, you know, they had sort of their own way of telling the history of that conflict.
And the Army adopts that. So we have battle streamers on the Army colors, the battle flag. And it says Antietam for our battle streamer, like a 2-foot-long streamer with blue over gray. But the Confederate... The units that have history with Confederacy, like the 167th Infantry in Alabama, their battle streamer is gray over blue and says Sharpsburg. And when does that come into being? 1949, in reaction to integration. They're fighting, the Army's fighting integration and allows these units, like the 167th Infantry, to highlight their Confederate service. And in 1971, the 167th changes their unit crest to highlight the 13 battles they fought as a Confederacy. And to this day, they now, that unit, wears a patch, unauthorized, that says 4th Alabama over their divisional patch. So we continue to have these same issues of this one period, 1861 to 1865, that has so affected our nation, and the memory of it affects us as well.
Well, and that, you know, that's, again, that's one of the great things that makes this a wonderful series of topics to talk about, right? So that at the Army Heritage and Education Center, one of the things that we do is specialize in using history for the purposes of learning. And that it's really that application of critical thinking with a perspective of historical mindedness or historical reasoning behind it, historical analysis. Because you can't talk about this topic without having a fundamental understanding, not just of the Civil War, but also of the period of reconciliation that came afterwards, as well as well into the 1950s. And so in this case, this provides a phenomenally excellent vehicle for our audience, because that's really what we're doing at the Army War College, is preparing senior leaders for employment at the top of the military or in government or advising diplomats. And so, you know, one of the fundamental things they have to do is lead teams of experts and with expert knowledge and get those teams to collaborate with others when looking at complex, unstructured problems. And so giving them something, you know, as sticky as a problem as has just been laid out provides a phenomenal vehicle for that discussion.
And the Civil War sort of is that.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the Civil War sort of ties all that together. You have the historical perspective, and you tie in the major changes that happened in society. You have the point of the country breaking apart, actually, and fighting against other relatives even,
right,
and people leaving the North and fighting for the South and vice versa. So it really adds a very difficult dimension to enact that critical thinking and to think outside the box and not just follow sort of what you think you know.
Right. And you see, you know, you see as a nation, we struggle with these with other similar issues, not the same issues, but it's very easy to devolve into a polarized conversation. And yet one of the things that we've got to do is coach our audience into, how do you have civil discourse on these issues? How do you have professional discussions on these things? How do you put them in the perspective of what was happening at the time?
General, go ahead. I know you had something you wanted to say.
Well, no, I think you're right. This is, but and also, why do we have? I mean, because this brings up emotion, because history is dangerous, because it goes after our identity and our myths and our legends. That's why it evokes such passion, and it evokes passion in me because I grew up with these myths and legends, and we have to understand why it is that we're doing this. One of the things that when I'm teaching history is that Don't tell me the problem. Tell me the story. Tell me the story of why it is that this subject evinces such passion in each person, and it will. And that, and if you go after that, you can base what you're talking about on facts. And the thing about the Civil War is that we have hidden facts to allow certain other things to happen. So in a major way, to ensure political power by white people in the South and throughout the rest of the nation, we've hidden some of the history of what the Civil War meant to ensure white political power in the South, which was through lynching and through Jim Crow and through segregation. And when we start uncovering that, we uncover real ugliness and real but facts. And so trying to get those facts out into the open to tell a different story, it'll make people upset. But you know what? It's not going to kill you. Being uncomfortable is not fatal. And as Americans, we can handle it. We really can. And so I'm looking forward to coming there to AAC, which is such a great organization, such a prize, a jewel of the U.S. Army. It's a great honor for me to come talk there.
We're talking with Brigadier General Ty Sejuli, Professor of History at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And a reminder, we will welcome your comments and questions right now. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532, weigh in on the conversation, or email us at smarttalk@wytf.org. That number is 1-800-729-7532. General, I want to follow up on what you just said a few seconds ago. The fact that this issue, when it comes to the Civil War, and you have folks who may say it's heritage, it's not hate. You have people who take that Southern pride in that particular period of history. Does the fact that this discussion is about military bases, does that sort of take that out of the equation, since this has to do with how the U.S. military is approaching its history?
Well, I think there's, you know, the way that, and it may upset people, but the way I think about it is people committed treason to preserve slavery. And in the U.S. Army, where we are dedicated to the Constitution of the United States, there's no doubt about it. We were founded to prevent rebellion. The Articles of Confederation did not allow an armed force to put down Shays' Rebellion in Massachusetts. So they changed it. And the Constitution allows us to put down rebellion. So Washington's, one of his first acts as president is to put the blue uniform back on, lead 12,000 troops into western Pennsylvania to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. The Army has put down rebellions for two centuries, and we may do it again. So our role is to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. Remember that the oath we take now was created in 1862 as an anti-Confederate oath. When you say enemies foreign and domestic, no purpose of evasion, that is an anti-Confederate oath. So in the 19th century, there was no doubt about the fact that we were there to put down rebellions, that we were the United States Army, and it only becomes muddied after the Civil War, particularly in the 20th century, when this idea of the lost cause of the Confederacy to change the narrative of the war comes about. But for U.S. Army soldiers, are we going to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic? You're damn right we are. And that's sort of why it's easier for the Army to just concentrate on the constitutional aspects of the Civil War.
And we have a call on the line right now. Eric from Harrisburg has a comment about General Lee's oath to the U.S. Eric.
See your screen and your friendly screener, and I'm enjoying this conversation. Well, I don't know all the history of the Civil War and the Revolutionary War, but if General Lee supposedly broke this oath, didn't Washington break an oath to the king? And secondly, if General Lee was not part of the United States, which he wasn't as a Confederate, he's part of another country. His oath to the United States is he was not part of the United States, he's part of another country. So it doesn't make sense to me to say that he's breaking an oath when he wasn't even part of the country, and when Washington and the colonists did the exact same thing that the Confederacy. Confederacy did.
Eric, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric. It's a great question. I think there are a couple parts to it. The first is, if I was in the United Kingdom and Great Britain, I may look at George Washington. You could look at him in that way. I don't tell people that they shouldn't look at him that way. But I'm a United States Army soldier and have been for more than three decades, loyal to the United States Constitution. So I look at it from that perspective. And Lee did take an oath to protect the and obey the orders of the president, protect the United States, just 2 weeks before he resigned to go take and fight against the United States. Was he part of a different country? He would have said he was. He believed he was a Confederate national. But from the constitutional perspective, which says that no state can form, and it says actually confederation, it's illegal to do that. If you believe in the United States, which I do, then I don't think Lee had the ability to do that. The other part that I have problems with Lee is he was one of the only ones who were senior Army officers to choose that course of action. He could have chosen differently. Most of his family did choose differently. So the idea that he would, that he could, that he had to do that, and the reason why I argue that Lee did choose differently is because of his because of his belief in enslavement. He was controlled more enslaved people than any other officer in the U.S. Army, and for 2 years between 1857 and 1860, he was actually not in the U.S. Army. He was on administrative leave, full pay, and running three enslaved labor farms, three plantations from his father-in-law. So I think he identified with slave owners much more than he did as a U.S. Army officer. And so, I certainly think you can have that view. But if you're a United States, if you're an American, and I am, and a soldier, which I am, then I believe in the U.S. and the Constitution. And George Washington founded this country, and Lee tried to destroy it.
So, Eric, thanks. You've highlighted why this is going to be a great topic and a great discussion tomorrow night.
Smiling over here.
and you know, this is, I just want to reemphasize that this is the first of a multi-part series of provocative topics. The first theme that we're doing, which starts tomorrow night, is about the influence of public sentiment on war memorialization. And so the following, each of these topics has two different authors that will present, and then we'll have a moderated discussion afterwards. Our second theme that follows will be about the influence of religion in conflict. And then our third theme, which we anticipate will happen in the fall, will examine how intelligence has been used for political purposes throughout history. And our fourth theme will take a look at the historic role of the U.S. Army in the Pacific region and some of those shifting, changing perspectives over time.
You're not taking it easy, are you? All right, well, we're going to wrap up the program. Retired Brigadier General Ty Sujuli is Professor Emeritus of History at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Thank you so much for your participation today. Really loved hearing your perspective.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was a great discussion. Look forward to being at the Army Heritage and Education Center on Thursday.
And good luck on Thursday. And Jeff Magelsdorf, the host of the discussion series and director of the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center as well, was part of today's program. Jeff, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, Tim, thank you for having us. And this has just been an excellent conversation. I look forward to continuing it Thursday evening, 6:30 p.m. out at the Army Heritage and Education Center, 950 Soldiers Drive in Carlisle.
And remember to listen tomorrow for Smart Talk with WITF's Katie Meyer. She'll be in for Scott Lamar. She's going to provide an outlook on the legislature's priorities in the new year. A reminder, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of the programs, including tomorrow's. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Tim Lambert.